Good morning, everyone. So the gentleman who walked up to me and offered the sheaf of betel leaves, he made a request on your behalf. He said, to save us from the suffering of samsara, would you please preach the Dhamma to us? Is that what all of you want? Are you sure? Are you dead sure? So you don't want me to beat around the bush? You don't want me to sugarcoat it? No? You sure? Are you sure? Are you sure you're sure? Okay. If you say so. You've been warned. Do you really understand that samsara is all suffering? You do? So why are you still there? Why are you still in it then? If you say that samsara is full of suffering, why are you still in it? Because there are ups just as much as there are downs? Do you believe so? That although there are the bad times, there are also the good times, and it's worth it? Then what still keeps you in samsara? These are rhetorical questions. I want you to think about them. My task here is simply to lay it out for you, just lay it down for you, as it is. Your wisdom will help you make sense of what I am about to share with you. Wisdom is not something that I can transfer to you. It is what you have earned out of the merits that you have sowed. That is why it is crucial on this path to your happiness. Your merits will continue to be your guide. It is your merits that have made you meet the Swaminvahanse, the monks, the Mahasangha in this manner. It is your merits that will help you remain throughout the duration of this talk. If at some point you get a call and someone says, there's an emergency, please can you come home as soon as you can? Then, at that point, you might have to get up and leave. Perhaps what you need, the understanding you need to become a sotapanna, will be uttered 2 minutes later. And then you'll have to wait for another day. Another day that may come, that may not come. Although we feel that we are in control of everything that's going on around us, ladies and gentlemen, that is not how it is. We just have this false sense of control. We feel that we are in control of everything. You can't even control the fact that you can hear what I'm saying right now, can you? If you're in this room, if you have the faculty of sound or hearing, and your ears are working as they should, you can't control hearing my words. It's not your choice, is it? Of course you can say, but I'm free to get up and leave, aren't I? If hearing was totally in your control, you wouldn't have to get up and leave. You should just be able to control it. The fact that you have to get up and leave simply means that you have to change one of the causes to achieve a different result. Meaning, it's not you who's in control, the causes are in control. So what are you really in control of? Your life, Do you think people who have to die, die out of choice? Then why do people die prematurely? Why do young children die in the incubation? Why do babies die in the mother's womb? If that's a choice. Life is not a choice. It's a result of causes. Death is not a choice. It's a product of causes. Being born is not a choice. It's a product of causes. Nothing is your choice. Even understanding what I'm telling you right now is also not your choice. You can understand exactly what I mean if you have the causes. All there is cause and effect. Understanding that is our victory. That is what the Buddhas do, ladies and gentlemen. They come into this world and they preach to people who feel that they're in control of everything. People who feel that they're the masters. We are no masters, we're all slaves. We're all slaves of the doctrine of the phenomenon of cause and effect. Once you've understood that, you surrender. See, in this game, there's only one way you can win. And that is by surrendering. In every other battle, you defeat your enemy. In every other battle, you defeat the other party. And then you become victorious. But in this game, it's different. The sooner you surrender, the sooner you win. Surrendering is victory. Surrendering to nature. Surrendering to how things really are. Surrendering to the truth. Your wisdom will help you achieve that sooner rather than later. Are you willing to surrender? It's not something you've ever done before, though. At school, at college, at university, at your workplace, you never surrendered. You always wanted to come out top. Always wanted to become first. Always wanted to win. You had your eye on the prize. They were the awards and the accolades that you wanted to win. The titles that you had to win. You didn't get a title for surrendering. At the championships, you don't get a cup for surrendering. You get a cup for defeating the other party. But here, it's a different game. You win if you surrender. Surrender to nature. Stop this fight that you're on. You're constantly trying to battle. You're constantly trying to fight nature. When nature wants to have its way, you have your own script. You have your own way. And then it's your way against nature's way. And when these two things come to contact, there's friction. Nature never suffers. If you clench your fist and bang it on a wall, what hurts? The wall or your fist? The fist, right? That's always how it is. If you fight against nature, nature always wins. You always lose. Nature is everything. Anicca, dukkha and anatta is what we need to understand to succumb to nature, to surrender to nature. Once you understand that, then you become no one. The problem you have right now is you are now someone. When you are someone, you have to maintain that someone. When you're a mother, if you believe you're a mother, you have to maintain your motherhood. You can only be a mother when your children are with you. So when nature decides it's time to take your children away from you, what do? When nature decides it's time to take your children away from you, what does a good mother do? She fights, doesn't she? She takes the children and goes to the doctor. She says, "Doctor, I'm not willing to give up my children. I want my children because that's what makes me a mother." Nature says, "No, it's time to take them." And you say, "No, it's not. I want them." Now, in your mind, you have fear. See, nature wants to do what nature wants to do, and you have a different agenda. When these two agendas clash, nature always wins. You always lose. This collision of agendas, ladies and gentlemen, is what we need to overcome. You have an agenda, nature has an agenda. When these two agendas become one, now you become nature. These words might sound like a riddle. I'm not speaking in riddles. I'm actually speaking the truth. To whatever level you'll understand what I'm saying is the level to which you will be able to comprehend what I'm saying. But I'm going to help you with this. This is almost impossible without someone's help. If anyone was able to do it without anyone's help, that was the Buddha, and the Buddha alone. What we do is we get the Buddha's help and the help from his disciples to ultimately become one with nature. That's all. I want you to become like the wind. I want you to become like the earth. I want you to become like the sky. Then you become nature. See, the earth has no choice. Whatever you throw onto the earth accepts it. If you had a gold coin and you bury it in the earth, it accepts it. If you spit on it, it accepts it. If you throw your rubbish, it accepts it. If you drop something precious, it accepts it. Whatever you throw onto the earth accepts it. Because earth is nature. The same goes for the air, the sky. Whatever you throw up, nature accepts it. Whatever you put into the water accepts it. If you spit into the water accepts it. If you pee into the water accepts it. Whatever you put into it, it accepts it. It never throws it back at you, does it? If you spit into the water, does the water spit it back at you? No, it doesn't. But if someone came and spat at you, what would you do? What would you do? You retaliate. That's why what I'm trying to explain to you is you are still not like nature. Nature always accepts. You fight back. Because you fight back, you suffer. If you can be of good mind, sound mind, if you can be someone who is able to accept whatever nature throws at you, now you become a man who doesn't suffer. But you can't just will yourself, wish yourself to this state. It comes through an understanding. It comes through the understanding that you are already part and parcel of nature. That's what we're here to try and figure out. So let's try and do that then. So to begin, let us bring our palms together. In veneration of the Buddha, our master, our guide and our teacher. He whose wisdom knows no bounds, he whose compassion knows no limits. It is because of him today we gather in this manner. It is thanks to his wisdom, his profound understanding and his infinite compassion today we are able to come together in this way to receive noble association. So that we and all of us may tread the path, the noble path, to the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. So, on this occasion, as we bring our palms together in veneration of His holy name, let us also take this opportunity to make a pledge of allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem. May the Noble Triple Gem continue to be my guide from now till the end of time.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස.
I want you all to understand your purpose on this planet. Your purpose as human beings. Most people get this wrong, ladies and gentlemen. Although it seems like it's a pretty obvious thing that we human beings must understand our purpose, hardly anyone does. Some people believe that the purpose of being alive, being a human being, is so that they can acquire a lot of knowledge, knowledge about everything, become knowledgeable. So there are people who dedicate their lives to the purpose of acquiring knowledge. School, university, bachelor's, master's, PhDs, postdoctoral, and it continues, goes on. Some people have several PhDs. None of these words are meant to insult anyone or offend anyone. But here's what I see. I see the elephant in the room. I see how people go through life not knowing what their purpose of having become human is. And they spend their valuable lives, lives that they have earned by sacrificing tremendous, making tremendous sacrifices. And then, having finally achieved this gift that is human life, they spend it worthlessly, acquiring things that actually will not make any sense to them, or provide them anything, or give any meaning to their lives, when all is said and done. If you are a PhD holder, if you are a doctor, you must know and understand that this is not the first time that you have become one. And on any previous occasion you became one, that didn't stick with you. When you died, it died with you. And so in this birth you had to do it all over again. Still, even if we didn't believe in a life after this, that's still okay, because this argument is still valid. There may be skeptics in this room who still don't believe in life after death, and that's okay, because that is not where Buddhism begins. It's where Buddhism ends. So you need not be concerned too much about whether there is life after death. That need not to be the crux of your understanding. Let that understanding come to you when it does. If after all of this, you come to the realization that you were right and there is no life after death, then so be it. That's not a problem. If after all of this, you realize that actually there is life after death, when we die, things are going to happen depending on what deeds we've done in our lives, then so be it. If after all of this, you're still confused, still, so be it. That is not what we're here to figure out. You know one thing for sure, for certain, and one thing for sure, and that is you have this life. Anyone in any doubt about that? It's a silly question. That you know for certain, that there is this life. So whether there is life after this or life before this, let's not make that our biggest concern. Whether there was or there wasn't, whether there will be or there won't be, that will come with time. But here's the important matter. Right now, you have a life. And your lives are precious to you. Anyone doubt that? Anyone disagree that your life is precious to you? Let me ask you a question. What is the most important asset to you? What is your most important, your most precious asset? What is it? Your money? Then? Being alive. Can we unanimously agree on that? Anyone disagree that life is not my most precious asset? There are other things that are far more important to me than life itself. Okay, I'll put it on the board then because we are all in agreement. When we do business, some of you may be in business. When we do business, we make investments, don't we? How does a good businessman work out whether an investment is a good one or a bad one? So you have something of value, let's call it an asset. You make an investment and you hope for a what return? Profit. You hope for a better return. So what you spend should be, or what you spend should earn you more than what you spent. That's when it's a good investment. That's when it makes good business sense. If you had a dollar and you spent it, you got $10 back, wouldn't you say that's good business? 90% profit. That's good business. If you had $10, you spent it, and you walked away with one at the end of your business, at the end of the day, at the end of your transactions, you walk away with a dollar having spent 10. Is that good business? Is it? Everyone? No. So to make good business sense, you have to be able to spend something you have and earn something that is more valuable than what you spent. That's when it becomes an investment, right? What were you born with? You were born with life. You were born with life. Life meaning your body and your mind. These two things together is when you say you are alive, right? When your body and your mind are together, you say you're alive. So when do you know you're not alive anymore? I mean, you wouldn't, but someone else would. When would they claim that you are no longer alive? When your body and your mind are not together anymore. Yes? Okay. So if that is what being alive is, then life is the two of them together. This is what you were born with. And you tell me that this is your most precious asset. Let's do some business then, shall we? I'm going to make a business proposal to you. You tell me whether you're happy to sign the contract. Right? I want you to give me some of your life. I give you a car. Today's not going to be a good day. But you asked for it. You give me some of your life. I give you a car. You can ask for whichever model or make you like. Right? Whichever trim, whatever sport model, hatchback, like, whatever you want. Whatever you like, just call it. You name it, I give you, but you have to give me something that you have. I give you something that I have. So I'll give you a car, you give me life. What do you say? Here's my ask. I'll give you a car that's worth $1 million. 5 million. I'll give you a car that's worth 5 million. You give me 10 years. 10 years of your most precious asset. I give you 5 million, a car worth 5 million. What'd you say? Come on. But you had to be true to your word. You don't have to say anything, but anything you say will be used against you. Right? So you're not happy with the car then. Okay. I'll give you a house. $50 million. I'll give you a house that is worth $50 million. How many bedrooms can you buy for $50 million? Well, it depends on where you live. Yes, I know what you're thinking. Samina, so we live in Colombo 7. That's probably like a one bed. I just say average, $50 million, right? 3-4 bed house. Big kitchen. Nice garage, so you can park your $5 million car. Okay? And every bedroom comes with an attached bedroom. Plenty of space for the children to play around. Right? It's got a lounge as well. You can sit comfortably, enjoy. Fully furnished. All included in the price. And all I ask of you is, $25 years. I mean, you have to pay a mortgage. Because although you think you're paying a mortgage, you're not actually paying a mortgage. That's what you think. That's what people make you think. They think that you're earning money and spending money. No. You were born with life. You're spending life. Because how do you earn money? By spending what? Spending life, right? You spend life to earn money, so indirectly, what are you spending? Life. So how much is a car? I say 5 million, you say? 10 years. How much is a house? I say 50 million, you say? 25 years. So now if you want a car and a house, come on, 35. Good deal, isn't it? Give me 35 years of your most precious asset. I'll give you my most precious assets. I have a really nice car. It's a lovely car. Brand new, right? 2024 model. Right? And I'll also give you a brand new house, fully furnished, in the best premium locations, right? All the amenities, easy access to all the facilities, right? Good schools around the area, right? Just right next to Gateway College. All I need from you is 35 years of your precious life. I have the contract. Come forward if you want to sign it. I'll give it to you now. But you have to give me 35 years of your life right now. No returns? That's right, isn't it? Say after 5 years of driving this car, you feel like, you know what, I don't like this car anymore. You take the car back to the showroom. Do they give you 5 years back? Do they? 10 years of living in your house, you feel like, you know, this is not the right house for me. I want to change location. I want to go for something different. You know, I like a different style. Different neighborhood. I don't like this anymore. So now you give the house back. You sell the house. Right? You've been living there for 10 years. Do you get your 10 years back? So, no return? No refunds. Come forward if you're willing to sign this contract. 35 years of your life, in exchange, I give you a car and a house. No takers? None? Right, let's go back to what makes good business sense. The first question I asked you is, What makes good business sense? And you said, for something to make good business sense, you have to make an investment. An investment is where you invest something that is of value to you, and in exchange, you must get something of more value. Yeah? Right, so I'm offering you something clearly of more value. Aren't I? See, I'm offering you a house and a car. Together it's worth 55 million. All I'm asking for is 35 years of your life. What? Don't you like the deal? Why? Life is more valuable. You say so. But your actions betray your words. Your actions betray your words, ladies and gentlemen. Where have the last 35 years gone? What were you doing over the last 35 years? You know, at any period during your lifetime, right? Several of those years you would have spent paying for the car that you bought so that you could call yourself a car owner. Because you walk outside, you see, look at the garage and you see a nice car. And you get into it, you drive it, you feel like you're driving a car. You enjoy that I'm a car owner feeling. For that, you had to spend 10 years of your life paying the car loan. Because these 10 years, you couldn't just stay at home and do whatever you wanted. You had to pay for your car. To pay for your car, you had to go work. So Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and weekends, you worked. You signed the business. You went and did business. You traveled the world. All not because that was not leisure. That was money. That was business. That was making money. Making money by spending life so that you could pay for a car. And you tell me that your most precious asset is your life. If that is your most precious asset, why, I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, do you choose to spend your most precious asset to earn something that is, in your opinion, far less valuable than it, than life itself? How does that make good business sense? You know what? Here's what I'll tell you. If I had 35 years of life, I wouldn't ask investment advice from you, unfortunately. If I had 35 years of life that I would want to invest, I'm not going to get investment advice from you. Please don't be mad at me. Because here's what you have done. With 35 of your life, you spent it to buy a car, in exchange for a car, and in exchange for a house. 35 years you spent doing that. Now you have a car and you have a house. 35 years later, from after you were born, these two things you now have, are you content? These are rhetorical questions. I'm not pointing at anyone in particular. Okay? I'm talking about the human condition. More or less, everyone has it. Are you content? If you are content, how come you're not happy? How come you still look forward to tomorrow? Someone who's happy today doesn't look forward to tomorrow because they're happy today. When you go to bed, don't you look forward to tomorrow? And you close your eyes and you think, tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be happy. Meaning, when you go to bed, you're not. What? Just make sure you don't die in your sleep. Because you're not going to die happy. Those who don't die happy aren't born happy either. That's the simple truth. Only those who die happy are born happy. Many people think that, you know, when parents age, right? When parents age, grandparents, right there on their deathbed, last few days, last few hours, many people think that she, he had a happy death. We like to fool ourselves by thinking that. They have many dreams, many hopes, many ambitions that were not fulfilled. You know, there's not a parent who's ever happy by seeing their children happy, because once their children are happy, then they have to see their grandchildren happy. These are all expectations that are a flame in the human heart. Whenever you have an expectation, that is not a moment in which you are happy. These are simple truths. Whenever you have an expectation in your mind, that is not a moment when you are happy, because an expectation does not bring you happiness. The fulfillment of an expectation relieves you of a stress that you're in when you expect. That's what happens. That's why when people have too many expectations, they go crazy. And those expectations cannot be fulfilled. An expectation leads you to disappointment when you can't achieve what you want. It leads you to relief from that expectation, or the frustration of expectation, when you achieve what you want. But an expectation itself is not something that keeps you happy. It's something that keeps you from being happy. That's why if you can become a human being, if you can become an individual who is free from expectations, there you have the makings of a happy person. But right now you have expectations, because if you have children, if you have property, if you have a pair of eyes and you wish to see, you have expectations. You expect to see certain things. There are things you like to see. That's an expectation. There are things you like to hear. That's an expectation. When you get home today, you'll have things that you'd want to do because you believe that they're going to make you happy. These are all expectations. At the workplace, you have expectations. So for as long as these expectations are alive in your heart, ladies and gentlemen, that is not a happy day. Yes, they'll tell you, expectation keeps a man alive. That's what keeps us alive. Well, if you only understood what they mean by being alive, then you'd realize that expectations are only a curse, they're not a blessing. Expectations are a vexation. But you can't help yourself from expecting, because of what people have done to you, because of the things that people have said to you, because of the ideas that you hold are true about this world. See, if I told you simply, quite simply, if I told you that I have something really nice behind this fan that I'd like to show you. It's very pretty, very beautiful. And I'm happy to, I'd like to show it to you. Now you have an expectation. You expect to see what I have to show you. In this moment, if you die, you die unhappy. It matters not what it is I have to show you. Because for as long as you're expecting what you want to see, not actually what I have in my hand. That's how expectations always are. If someone tells you, hey, I've got something really interesting to show you, would you like to see it? Regardless of what your mouth utters, what does your mind say? And someone says, I've got something really interesting to show you. Would you like to see it? Regardless of what your mouth speaks, what does your mind say? Yes, please. It matters not what it actually is. Believe me. See, when you get home, someone says, look at what the dog has done. And you turn around and say, what? You want to see what the dog has done. You know what the dog has done. Or if someone says, what's that smell? It's awful. What do you do? In that moment, what do? You say, show me. And you take a deep breath in, don't you? See? whether it's a fragrance or a stench, you still want to know what it is. Expectations. This is the ugly truth. If you hear a fart in the room, someone's passed wind, right? Don't nod your heads in agreement because you don't want to embarrass yourselves. Right? If someone's passed wind in the room and you hear the sound, what do you normally do after that? Let's be honest. Let's be honest. I'm here to talk about who you are, right? When you're here, you know, with your teacher, with your doctor, and with your lawyer, don't pretend to be something you're not. Once again, with your teacher, with your doctor, and with your lawyer, don't pretend to be something you're not. Here, you're with your teacher. This is your Dhamma teacher. I'm here to show you what you really are inside of you. If you hear a noise, and you know that someone's just farted, you want to know what that smells like. Everyone's like that. You're not special. Because the mind is curious. Because the mind goes into a state of expectation. The mind wants to know what is it like. Just imagine if you died at that point. If you died at that point, now you died clinging on to, well, what the Buddha, if you go by what the Buddha says, if you cling on to something at the moment of your death, when you're born, you'll be born in that kind of environment. Plenty of such things have happened even in the sasana. There was one occasion where a monk, he was offered a new robe, and he was so fascinated by this robe. He got himself so attached to this robe. So the robe was offered and he was due to wear it the following morning. It was in his kuti. That night he passed away, but even as he went to bed at night, he was looking at his robes, thinking to himself, tomorrow morning the first thing I'm going to do when I wake up is put that robe on me. He passed away that night. The following morning, the novice monks, they walked into the room and they realized that the monk had passed away. Then they went into the room to help themselves to whatever was left, and they realized there was a brand new robe. The Buddha was available at the time. He looked through his divine powers and he realized that it was not the appropriate time to be taking that robe. So he sent a message to the young samanera saying, please don't take any of his belongings right now. Include particularly not the robe. So they listened to the Buddha and they left the robe there. 7 days later, the Buddha said, now you can take it. And so later on, the monks, when they sat around the Buddha on one occasion, they asked him, Venerable Sir, why did you say that we were not supposed to take those robes for the 7 days upon the monks passing away? And the Buddha said, at the moment of this monk's death, in his mind he was clinging on to that robe. What you didn't know was, he died and he was born a tick on the robe. For 7 days, he clung on to that robe. He couldn't let go. If anyone had taken that robe, he would have agitated him a lot. And then he would not have let the monk, whoever the monk was, to wear that robe in peace. He would have bothered them, bitten them for having taken what belonged to him. But after 7 days, the tick died. And then the Buddha said, now you can take it. See, if these things happen, even in the sasana, if you have an expectation and you die with an expectation, ladies and gentlemen, you don't die happy. So therefore, you can't be born happy. Now, people live their lives with so many expectations. Expecting to have tomorrow, expect you to do things tomorrow, expect you to see things tomorrow, to smell things, to hear things, to do things tomorrow, in the next moment. What if you die in this moment with your expectations for the next moment? But even if you didn't believe in a life after this, a moment of expectation is a moment in which you are unhappy. That is why you don't like to remain with expectations. You want those expectations to be fulfilled. That's why you pay extra so that you don't have to stay in the queue. Normally there's a queue, there's a free queue, and there's a paying queue, isn't there? So you can pay a premium price and then you don't have to wait. Because when you wait, you wait expecting, and that expectation is not a happy thing. It hurts, it's agonizing, it's frustrating. When the mother is about to be informed about the gender of her child, the mother is in a lot of expectation. So imagine they called her in and they did a scan and said, right, so we are going to announce the gender of your child, and it is a... Actually, the scans are not clear. You're going to have to come back tomorrow. Anyone who's been a mother, you will know the feeling. As you wait for your child to be delivered to you, you know what I'm talking about. Expectation is not all that it seems to be, all that it's hyped up to be. But people just keep on throwing expectations at you, throwing information at you so that expectations arise in your mind. And this is exactly what takes away the happiness that you have in this moment, ladies and gentlemen. When people plant expectations in your mind, you can't live in the present. You are transported into the future. That's what happens. So about the future, you're always fearful. You're always afraid. Like I asked you the other day, can you name one point in the future in which you can guarantee that you will be happy? Name one point in the future that you can guarantee that you will be happy. Can you guarantee that you will be happy 5 minutes from now? Guarantee that you will be happy in 5 minutes from now? Can you? You can't, because you don't know what call you're going to get in 5 minutes' time. You don't know if the person who sat next to you, your loved one, is just going to go unconscious, drop dead. You don't know if that's going to happen in the next 5 minutes. You don't know if you're going to get a call from your loved ones and someone says your father's passed away, your mother's passed away. You don't know if your wife's going to ring you and say, I've just had a miscarriage. You don't know if these things are going to happen, so you can never be certain about a future happiness. Therefore, don't expect a future happiness. But what do people always expect? To be happy in the future. The future never brings happiness. This is why people are not happy. People don't get this stuff. And it's so simple. People live their lives always expecting to be happy in the future. But the future, by its very design, cannot bring you happiness. The future can only bring you fear. Don't you agree with me? Your son rings you and he says, Mom, I'm going to be coming down for my vacation. I'm flying tomorrow. So tomorrow you're waiting to see him, collect him from the airport. Now you have a hope that tomorrow is going to bring you happiness. But before he comes, something else has already come. What's that? Fear. He hasn't arrived yet. You only have the hope of his arrival, but something has already arrived. And that is fear. So it's going to be 48 hours before you see your son. Throughout those 48 hours, what are you going through? What are you going through? Fear. Because you have an expectation to see him in 48 hours. In those 48 hours, one thing can be guaranteed, you are afraid. You are scared. You live in fear. See what expectation does to you? I can tell you one thing. 48 hours from now, your son may or may not arrive. Agreed? Your child may or may not arrive. But one thing most definitely arrived throughout those 48 hours. What was that? Fear. This is the price you pay. This is the price you pay for expecting a happiness to come to you from the future. That's why I ask you to live in the present. But you can't live in the present, ladies and gentlemen, for as long as you believe that a future is going to bring you happiness. That's why I'm here to help you. To teach you that this is happiness. This is the present moment. This is now. This is the citta. You are gifted with that. You are born, let's just say, with 100 years of life. The truth is, you are born with 100 years of chittas. That's what you are born with. 100 years of happiness, that's what you are born with. But here's what you do. You tell me what you do. Car. I remember when I was a young boy, right, when I was about 5-6 years of age, when I walked outside, I saw nice cars. People drove in like really nice cars. I didn't think it was a nice car until someone said that was a nice car. First of all, I didn't even know what it was, and someone said that's a car. And then people said, well, there are nice cars, there are fancy cars, there are expensive cars. There are luxury cars. And then I asked, what does that mean? Well, then they said, well, come on in. Have a look. Look at the paintwork. Look at the interiors. Look at the exterior. Look at the sport grill. Look at the aerodynamics. Look at how fast it can go. Look at how fast it can go from 0 to 80 in a matter of seconds. That's what people told me. And then from 6 years old, I wanted to be a car owner. I remember, ladies and gentlemen, to this day, how growing up, I always wanted to have my own car. Am I the only one in this room who was like that? If you and I are both earthlings, then we must have gone through the same emotions. I remember from 5, 6, 7 years old, I wanted to have a car. And I had a particular brand of car I wanted. So my friends would come and show me pictures. And then if there was someone in the family, or maybe a family friend who had a nice car, I'd love to visit them. So I'd go and ask him, uncle, can you give me a drive, please? Can you give me a ride in your car? Can you take me around? And they would. So what they'd do is they'd get me in the car and they'd give me a ride and say, Buddha, one day. One day what? You can? You can own one. What must you do for that though? Work hard. Study hard. Earn money. And then one day, you can become the proud owner of something like this, said my uncle. And he had a smile on his face, just like I have one on me right now. I fell for it. So don't you fall for this. Don't you fall for it before checking the facts. Do a fact check. Do a fact check. Before you fall for a smile. I didn't. I thought it was fact when it was all fiction. My uncle, who was having arguments and fights with his wife at home, was driving around in a car and telling me that that was what made him happy. I couldn't piece two and two together to make sense. How could he have arguments at home and be unhappy and then claim to be happy because he was a car owner? How could he have frustrations and disappointments and be angry if he was also a car owner? And by virtue of what he was saying, if you're a car owner, you're a happy man. That's what he used to say. Then he used to show me his collection of cars. Not did he didn't just have one car, he had many cars. He said, Buddha, one day, if you're like me, if you work hard, if you become rich, you can be like this. And there was me, the 6-year-old. So gullible. So naive. All those indoctrinations, all those justifications were happening in my mind. And so here's what I thought. I'm going to spend the next 20 years of my life to somehow try and earn myself a car. And eventually I did. And I was still unhappy. In vain, those 20 years. In vain, those 20 years. Now, do you think I could go back to my uncle and say, hey, uncle, what man, you promised me that I could buy a car and then be happy. So I spent my 20 years trying to find a car. Now I have a car. I'm still not happy. What do you say? He said, Buddha, car is not enough. You have to have a house also. And then I asked him, how many more years is that? Is this just my life I'm relating to you, or have you not heard a similar story from someone else that you might know? Very well indeed. So what happened to those 100 years? How many of that have you got left now? You were born with the most precious thing that you say you had, or you still have some of it, and you kept on spending that. You kept on spending that to buy a car, to buy a house. What else have you bought? What about starting up your own business? I had another uncle. These are the uncles who ruined my life. Let me share some of those stories with you. As I always say, before you take a smile as granted, do a fact check. Don't fall for a smile until you've done the fact check. Don't fall for this smile until you do a fact check. Do a fact check. Does he speak the truth? Can he attest to what he says? You've got to do a fact check. Verify. Because I fell for many of these. And then I paid the price. I paid the price with my life. Business. Out of business. How many years of your life must you spend to build a good business? Businessmen, women in the house, please be kind and generously share your experience. How many good years of your life, of your most precious asset, would you have to spend to build up a business that you can be proud of one day? I had an uncle. Did I tell you? I had an uncle who was a good businessman. Also, he said, Buddha, is going to school, going to campus, going to university, that's not going to make you, that's not going to float your boat. That's not going to be your cup of tea. Start a business. When you start a business, you can be your own boss. Right? You can be your own boss. You can have a staff. And they'll call you sir as you walk into the room. They respect you. You can decide your own working hours. Right? When you want to work, you can work. When you don't want to work, you don't have to work. But what they didn't tell you is, in the end, you had to work throughout the clock. Right? Around the clock, you have to work. Yes, you can choose, but the choice is, it's not a choice at all, really. You just have to work. Because when it's your business, you have to be there all the time. When it's someone else's business, you have to be there 9 to 5. So how many years of your life did you invest in your business? I know you're still investing your life in your business, but just for argument's sake. 30 years to start from scratch and work it up to where it is today? Today it's a money-generating business, yes, I give you that. It makes a lot of money. You have many contacts. Maybe it's a multinational company, perhaps. Maybe it's a conglomerate. 30 years of your life you spent on that. Your father also did that. You inherited the business from your father, perhaps. He did that for 50 years of his life, and then he passed it on to you, like it was a fully baked cake, but no, you had to bake it again. Right? He said, Buddha, I built my business from scratch. 50 years of my life I spent here, it is inheritance to you. And from the day you took it on, what did you have to do? Continue. So it was not fully baked. It had to constantly be in the oven. So 30 years of your life is spent on your business. And you're still spending. I'll ask you the question again then. Give me 30 years of your life and I'll give you a good business. Come on. I'm only asking for 30 years of your life. I have a good business. It makes a lot of money. And I'm happy to give it to you, but you have to give me 30 years of your life. So, for example, if you were 30 years right now, the moment I hand over this business to you, you grow, you age by another 30 years instantly, and now you're 60. If you're up for that, please come forward. If you're 60 now, and you come forward, and then you sign the contract, the moment you sign the dotted line, the business is yours, but you are now 90 years old. So in exchange for 30 years of your life, I give you a business. Please come forward. None of you even dare get up from your seats, let alone come forward. Because you know one thing for certain. There is nothing quite as precious as life. But what you have been doing throughout the last 30 years, 40 years, 50, 60, 70, 80 years is spending parts of it, acquiring things that are not quite as valuable. Does that make good business sense? I ask you. Because the very first question I asked you was, what makes good business sense? And all your wisdom put together, you told me that what makes good business sense, Swami Nuhansa, is to make an investment. You put in a dollar, you walk away with 10. If you were to put in 10 and you walk away with 1, that's a loss. It's a mighty loss. What have you been doing with your lives? What have you been doing with your lives? You were given an opportunity to be happy. You were given an opportunity to be happy. You were given 100-year lease to be happy. It came guaranteed with happiness. Each chitta was born happy, guaranteed. But here's what happened. Expectations lay on your mind, one after the other, after the other. And then you started setting expectations for the future. I started setting expectations for the future. I was looking to a happiness that would come to me in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 15 years' time, 20 years' time, 25 years' time, 30 years' time. I remember when I was a young boy, and I was attracted to a girl, and I wanted her to be my wife one day. So I asked my mother. She said, ask your uncle. So when can I make her mine? Because I see that people live together, they've made each other theirs. So apparently there's this concept where people can own other people. Seemed a bit weird to me at the beginning, but later on I realized that that is how the world works. You can own people, apparently. Like you own pets, you can own people. You just have to sign a piece of paper. Right? So if it's a mutual agreement, then you end up owning the other person. But what you don't realize is you don't just end up owning them, you also own their parents as well. So they come as a package with in-laws and all that. They don't tell you about that. That's in the small print. I know what those smiles are. You know, there's a story behind each other. I know. Been there, done that, Swami Nuhansa. Yeah, I know exactly. Yeah, I know. Right? We've all been there. So when I was younger, I also wanted to have a life partner. It was the thing to do. Because at school, you know, we had Ayyas. We were the Mallis at school initially. They were the Ayyas. And the Ayyas used to come up and, Malli, don't you have someone in your life yet? I said, no, am I supposed to? Yeah. Because they'd scribble, like, initials on the furniture. Apparently that's what they make furniture for. At our monastery, you can ask our Anagarika Putas, and you see them from time to time. At our monastery, I said, if I ever spot anyone scribble an initial or a name or anything of that sort on any of the furniture that our devotees have so devotedly offered and donated to the Sri Sambuddha Sasana, that'll be the day that you'll hear from me. So at our school, at the monastery, none of that is allowed. Furniture is not designed or not made for people to scribble on them. It's to be used. It belongs to the Buddha. The walls, the doors, the furniture, it all belongs to the Buddha. The floor that we walk on, it belongs to the Buddha at the monastery, because all of that was offered to the Buddha. We use it because he allows us to. That's it. So you don't have vandalism at the monastery. We don't allow that. We take it very seriously. Because, you know, as a gentleman, as a gentle lady, our children must learn that such things are not good. But every school I've been to, both here and in other countries, which is so unfortunate, that young people think that public property is for them to vandalize, to throw their graffiti on. Walk into any washroom, any toilet, any public toilets, wherever. Scribbles and phone numbers and sex symbols and all sorts. You know, that is the mindset that people, you can't blame them for it. That's how vexed people are. You must wonder why, you know, when a child walks into a washroom, and all they go in there is to relieve themselves of a physical discomfort. For them to then take their pencils and start drawing things on the walls, just imagine how vexed they must be. Just think about that mentality. They don't write Namo Buddhaya, do they? We don't have that at the monastery. And it's not because I have warned them. It's because we give them the Dhamma. But ask your child when you get back home. Ask them if they've ever scribbled on the furniture at school, whether they've written their initials. I mean, what does it gain you by writing your initials with your girlfriend's or your boyfriend's initials? What does that gain you? Does it bring you closer to them, or what, you know, gives you a discount on the dowry? I mean, what does it do? There's nothing. But why do they do that? Because they want that feeling that I am in love. I have someone special for me. It's an inadequacy that people try to fulfill. By going into this mental state that they are always with me. So when you see that person's initials next to yours, you know what it's like, right? If you're Sam and she's Tammy, right? That's how it is. Anyway, I digress. But at least with your children, teach them that that is not something they're supposed to do. It's a terrible habit. It's rife, it's there everywhere. Right? Even if you walk into the best schools, you'll still see that. You walk into a washroom, look at the doors, look at the walls, public toilets, nothing, you know, you need not even mention about them. But your children should not be like that, is all I'm saying. We can't fix every child in the world, but your children should not be like that. So even if they at home scribble things on the furniture, teach them lovingly. This is not to admonish them, just lovingly teach them, Buddha, why did you do that? Why do you feel that you have to scribble? Is that what furniture is for? Is that what a desk is for? To scribble things. Even on the back of books, some just doodle on the back of books. You know, they just scribble things. Teach them. That's not what we use, how we use our books. Anyway, that's a lesson for another day. I'm talking to the wrong audience. Bring your children, I'll talk to them. Bring them to the monastery. Then we can do a program for them and teach them good manners, good habits, good behaviors, to live like good citizens, respectable individuals. You know, before Nibbana, that has to come. If you can't be a law-abiding, good citizen who respects and regards other people's property, then Nibbana is a long way away. You have to be a gentle monk before you can become an Arahatun Mahansa. Where were we? Business. 30 years of your life you spent doing up your business. Oh yeah, I was saying I had a crush on someone when I was younger. So I went and asked my uncle and he said, what? Well, if you want her to be yours, then you have to wait. You have to work hard. You have to get yourself a good job. You have to impress her. You have to impress not only her, but also her. You have to impress her family. And her aunts and her uncles and everyone in the family, you have to impress them. And then eventually she might just say yes. So I had an expectation of happiness for the future. I had a happiness in the future. That's what I thought. But I couldn't be further from the truth, ladies and gentlemen. Happiness is never in the future. It's never in the future. Think of one thing in the future that you expect to happen right now. Just think of something in this moment. Think of something that you're expecting to happen in the future. Has it happened yet? No, because it's in the future. But you have the fear of it, don't you? Might it happen? Might it not happen? What if it doesn't happen? What if it doesn't go to plan? See, the fear of it is with you right from this moment. It may or may not happen tomorrow or whenever it's due to happen. And even when it does, here's the sad part of the story. Here's the tragedy. Even when it does, it's not the event that brings you happiness. It's your longing for it to happen and the vexation that comes with that and your relief that you experience. That is what brings you happiness, not the event. What a tragedy. What a tragedy. I don't understand why people want to live such miserable lives when there's an alternative. I want all of you to be free of expectations. Being free of expectations does not mean being free of duties and responsibilities. I have plenty and more of duties and responsibilities to fulfill, and I'm quite happy doing all that. But I have zero expectations, just like when I'm here and I'm preaching to you. I have a duty to preach to you. It is my responsibility to help as many people in this world to attain Nibbana while I still can. Do you remember when I was unwell? Those days I used to come here with a bad cough and I'd still preach to you because I had a duty. I'm duty bound. The Buddha has given me that duty. He bestowed that duty on me at the moment he gave me these robes. Your own Nibbana and Nibbana for others, that is what your life is for. That is what he said, and I dedicated myself to that. That is my duty, but here's what I have. Zero off. Zero expectation that you must attain Nibbana. Because if I had an expectation that you must attain Nibbana, where would that leave me? Disappointed. Because then, that is not Nibbana. I want you to attain Nibbana for your own sake, not for my sake. I'm here to do my duty. I will preach the Dhamma and I will explain to you as long as I have energy left within me. And as long as you're here and as long as we are here, we meet together, I will do my duty. You need to do your duty to yourself. So I don't keep my expectations that you will attain Nibbana. I'll ask you, come into robes where you can. Become a Sila Sravaka, become a Sila Sravika, become a Sila Vesi, so that you can associate the Dhamma, associate the monastery better and closer and have noble association around the clock. I'll keep talking to you about it, but my expectations are not with you. My love is with you. My compassion is with you. My loving kindness is with you, but not my expectations. Because I don't trust you will fulfill them. Because it is not your choice, ultimately. It's your merits and your understanding of the Dhamma. You know what? I know that if it were your choice to do what I ask you to do, you would do it at the drop of a hat. I know you would. Let me say that again. I know that if it were your choice to do what I ask you to do, you would do it the moment I ask you. But it's not. Then what is it? Your merits and to the degree to which you understand the Dhamma. It's not your choice. So with these two things, you must understand the Dhamma and also have merits. If these two things come together, then you will do as I ask you to do. But if not, it's not possible. And of course, yes, there are other duties and responsibilities that keep you bound to your existing lifestyle, which I also understand. So a number of different factors keep you from doing what I really like you to do. So it would be unwise of me to hang my hat of happiness on your hook. So I don't. But that doesn't stop me from coming here and preaching to you. I will do it even if no one among you will one day at least decide to come into the sasana. Even if no one decides to do that, if you're here, then that is you acknowledging that you need to do something with your lives. And that's enough for me. If there's even one person in this room, I will talk to them. So the problem then is expectations. When you look back at your lives, you tell me that this is the most precious thing that you have, but you have been expending the most precious thing that you have to be acquiring and earning things that are far less valuable than that. So I ask you, would you give me 10 years of your life in exchange for a 5 million car? And you say no. Would you give me 25 years of your life in exchange for a 50 million house? And you say no. How about the two of them together? And you still say no. What about a business? I'll give you a business, a very well-functioning, profit-making business in exchange for 30 years of your life. And you say no. Well, you keep on saying no, but that's what you keep doing. That's the irony of it. But I also know why you do that. That's because you think there's no alternative. What choice do we have, Swami Nuhansa? You know, as the gentleman walked up to me, and he offered the leaves, and he, the, the, the beetle leaves, and he looked at me in my face, and I saw in his face, because he's here to represent all of you, I saw in his face a plea for compassion, a plea for loving kindness, a plea to help you all out of the dream that you're in. If you'd spent 25 years of your life to own a house, ladies and gentlemen, here's the sad part of that story. You don't actually own it. You think you do. You don't actually own anything. You think you do. That's why you also want others to think you do. Don't you agree? That's why you have a piece of paper, which you prove in a court of law, which you file in some registry with some registrar. There's an office somewhere in which they have a record of the things that you own. So when someone asks, who owns this? You can prove it with a piece of paper. Without that piece of paper, you own nothing. If someone took away the title deeds of your property, what do you own? If your bank, in which you have deposited, say, 10 million rupees, in your bank you have deposited this money, and the bank loses their record-keeping system, right? Their computers get hacked, and all their data is lost. Now how much money do you have with the bank? Now how much money do you have with the bank? And you have no evidence to prove. Let's just say there's no certificate that you have, no FD certificates or no books to prove it, no passbooks, no other documents to prove it. If you walked up to the bank and said, well, I don't know, I put my money in here, can I have it back, please? And the bank says, well, we can't give it to you just yet because we are still trying to establish who owns what. At that point, can you say, no, you don't. I don't have to prove it. I own it. 10 million of my money is in the bank. It's with you. I own it. Why should I prove it? It's mine. What was the bank going to say? Go flyer? Yeah. See, if something is really yours, why should you have to prove it to someone? The very reason that you have to prove your ownership is because it's not something that you own. Ownership is a convention. If everyone agrees that you own something, apparently you own it. Apparently. Can you walk up to the adjacent land and just claim it? You know, just a land adjacent to this property. You walk into there and say, this is mine. What would they do if you did that? What would they do? They'd call the police. Right? They'd have you escorted. Why? Why? Because no one agrees. No one else agrees. Now let's just assume you actually thought that was your property. Let's just assume you actually think that it's your property, right? You are not trying to play tricks on anyone. You're not just playing a practical joke or anything like that. You actually thought that it was your property. You walked into your neighboring land and your neighbor's land, and you said, "This is my property." Because you actually think it's yours. What they do at that point is they call in convention. They ask people. Your neighbor says, no, it's not, it's mine. Then they ring the police. And the police asks, right, whose is this? It's mine. How so? Here's my deed. It's my property. And then they'll take you away. Just because you think something's yours, is not yours. Meaning, nothing is yours. So then tell me, what did you spend 10 years of what was actually yours? Whose is your life? That's yours, right? Who's the car? Your life being yours is at a convention. Your life is yours, is that a convention or is that an absolute reality? That's an absolute reality. Your life is yours. It's not up for discussion. No one's arguing with you, right? That's actually yours. So 10 years of what's actually yours, you spend to earn something that's not actually yours. Some people are so poor that all they have is money. Don't you think so? Don't you be that person. Some people are so poor that all they have is a car. All they have is a big bank balance. All they have is a 50 million house. That's how poor they are. They don't have the common sense to understand what I'm trying to explain here. They don't have the wisdom to understand what I'm trying to get across. And so they don't have happiness. When the Buddha was asked, I was having a chat with one of our Swami Mahasis yesterday, and a really interesting point came up in our discussion. I'll share that with you. I told him, Swami Mahansa, see how poor people are, that they think when they have lots of money, they think they're rich. So he asked me, what do you mean by that, Swami Mahansa? I said, let me explain. People think they're rich when they have lots of money. What they forget is what brings them money. When the Buddha was asked, sir, to be considered someone who's wealthy, what must one have? This is a question that was put to the Buddha. To be considered wealthy, what must one have? And the Buddha names seven things. Now I'll tell them to you. You ask yourself whether you have any of these, some of these, all of these, and to what extent. Okay? Number one, US dollars. Why are you laughing? Why are you laughing? Wrong currency, right? British pounds. Okay, I'll tell you what the Buddha said. He said, Shraddha. Shraddha. Conviction. Conviction of the Dhamma. To know that nothing other than the Dhamma is the truth. He said it was an asset. I'll explain to you why in a moment. Folks, if the Buddha says something, don't take it lightly. He doesn't speculate. He doesn't guess. He knows. Shraddha, number one. Your conviction of the Dhamma. To know that nothing other than the Noble Triple Gem is the path to happiness. Do you think Steve Jobs knew that? Who's the richest man alive now? Elon Musk? Do you think he knows that? Do you think our good friend Mr. Zuckerberg knows that? But these are rich men. People who have a lot, but they have nothing. I don't speak out of spite, as you know. I'm not entitled to spite. I'm a monk. I'm only entitled to compassion and loving kindness. If you could one day bring them to me, and I will instill within them the seven assets that the Buddha claims makes a man wealthy. I can do that. We can all do that. If you can, bring them here one day. Shraddha. Sila. Your virtue. Number two, virtue, your sila. How virtuous you are. deep down inside how virtuous you are. Not what you do, what you don't do to the outside world physically, inside of you, whether you have a cool heart. That is what sila is. Hiri, number three. These are Pali terms. Hiri. And number four is ottappa. The two of them together is fear and shame of sins, unmeritorious deeds, unskillful deeds, unwholesome deeds. To have fear and to have shame of unwholesome deeds. Can you see the profoundness of those words? See, this is by the Buddha's definition what makes a wealthy man. What makes you rich? Because you know what? If you have all these things, you need not worry about happiness, because money does not bring happiness. It's these things that bring happiness. How do you know? Tell me, how do I know? I don't have a penny to my name. But these are my assets. So, Shraddha, Sila, Hiri, Ottappa. Four. Panya. Wisdom. The mental faculty to be able to understand the truths about this world. The mental faculty, wisdom, the faculty of wisdom. Not everyone has that. Some people can make sense of the world, how the world works, how to send man to the moon, but they can't make sense of any of this. That is why the fact that you keep coming here, despite me not sharing with you how to make money, how to make good investments, how to earn the next dollar, right? I'm teaching you stuff that the Buddha taught, and you're still here. This seems to interest you. So you must have some level of wisdom, because this is not the kind of thing that a businessman might look for. This is the kind of thing that wise man looks for. Because here we learn how to be happy. Next, sutta. Sutta is to have heard. Heard what? Michael Jackson. To heard the Dhamma. To have heard the Dhamma. In other words, you can think of it in this way. To have the association of noble ones. You tell me that's not an asset. I dare you. If you can, you tell me that to have the association of a noble one is not an asset. If that were so, I'd be a very poor man today, because that is all I have. I'm surrounded by noble ones. Number seven, chaga. Chaga, these are the Pali terms. What it means is, to give, charity, the ability to give, the ability, the mental ability to let go, to be generous, to be charitable. Shraddha, Sila, Hiri, Ottappa, Panya, Sutta and Chaga. The seven assets that make a man wealthy. I don't have a penny to my name. But you don't need money to be happy. A lot of people don't understand these truths. They think to have assets is to have a good business. They think to have assets is to have a coconut plantation or a a tea plantation, a rubber plantation, to have a big factory, to have a big staff, have a big company, to have many cars. People believe that these are the things that make them wealthy, but they don't fear unmeritorious deeds. They don't fear sin. They're not afraid of doing unmeritorious deeds. And you know what happens next? They carry on doing such things. They don't have noble association. They don't have the wisdom. They don't have sila. They don't have virtue. They're not virtuous. They sin. They steal. They rob. They take what belongs to others. They damn others. They don't look after their stuff. They exploit them. They don't like to share what they have earned from their enterprise with others. They try to keep all their profits for themselves. And they treat their people, the people who work their socks off for them, like the scum of the earth. There are people who do that and think that they're very wealthy. That's very short-lived. What they don't realize is the fact that they have these things today means they have had the things that I just mentioned a little while ago before. Today, they have given up on all that, all those good things, all those seven things that the Buddha speaks of makes a man wealthy. And today, they hoard their money, their assets, their property, thinking that that is what makes them wealthy. Tell me that is not what's going on out there in the world. Where's people's generosity? Where's people's charity? Where's people's virtuousness? Where's people's fear and shame to do bad things, unskillful things, unmeritorious and unwholesome things? Aren't there people who claim to be rich, wealthy people who'll kick their mothers and fathers out of their houses when they feel like, you know, that's it, they're just too old? Why look after them? Why bother about looking after them? We have our business to look after. Where's sila? What they don't realize is what they have today is very short-lived. Soon enough, they will lose it all. I want all of you to have the best of both worlds. I want all of you to have the best of both worlds as I do today. You know, I not only have the happiness of mind, but when I want to get from Ingiri to Rajagiri, there's a car waiting outside to pick me up. See? I have the best of both worlds. When I'm hungry, all I have to do is take my alms bowl and go out and look up at the sky and go, God, I'm here begging. And He gives me my daily bread. He doesn't give me enough for tomorrow because it's daily bread. What you need now, He gives. Isn't that enough? Because you're only here for today. So why save for tomorrow? If all you are is the chitta that's in the present moment, why worry about tomorrow? Because about tomorrow you only have one thing, that is fear. You have stuffed in your cupboards right now, right? In your kitchen, right? You have your biscuits or whatever you have in your kitchens right now. Aren't you afraid that the cockroaches might get to it? And the rats might get to it? And the rodents, whatever you have at home, might get to it. See? You haven't even eaten the biscuit yet. That is to be eaten tomorrow. You can't enjoy your biscuit today because it's in the cupboard, but you're afraid that the rats will get to it before you do. That's with you today. Don't you feel you've got the short end of the straw? See, if you can truly become a human being that lives today, just today, live today. I'm not even talking about living now. I'm talking about living today to begin with. Live for today, just today, because tomorrow might never come. Problem is, you can't do that because in your mind you have expectations. Because you have a wife, you have a husband, you have children, and along with them you have lots of expectations of them and for them. So if your wife falls ill, if your children fall ill, you have to have an insurance plan for them. You have to have some kind of protection for them. So you have to work so that their tomorrow can be safe. But as you wait for their tomorrow to be safe, today you're not safe. Today, you're in a prison, the prison of fear. See what you have sacrificed to gain a happiness that never comes. I wouldn't mind it if that happiness was actually true happiness, but it's not. I wouldn't have spoken to you so passionately if the happiness that you experience in your lives was true happiness, ladies and gentlemen. It's not. You have been fooled. You have all been fooled. It's a pretty bad deal. You are very intelligent human beings. You're very wise. You're very learned. You're educated. You're very experienced. Put all of you together, and the knowledge that you all have far exceeds any knowledge that I can ever hope to achieve in my life. All of your experience together far exceeds any experience that I can ever have in my life. But I ask you this. What has all that got you? What has all that gained you? Why are you today still in a trap that other people have put you in? Because they themselves were in a trap. They didn't know any better. It was a case of the blind leading the blind. And now you're at a dead end. You don't know where to go. Today you have a car, you have a house, you have a business, but you're not happy. You were born with 100 years of happiness. 10 years of that you spent on paying your car loan. 25 years of that you paid your mortgage. 30 years of that you paid to build yourself your business. You're still not happy. Put another 20-odd years education. Put another few years bringing up your family. See, you're in a web. You're stuck in a web. The spider that is the Asat Purusha has weaved this web for you. And now you're just stuck in it. You're struggling trying to get out, but you can't. The more you struggle, the more you get entwined in it. I'm seeing that from here. Oh, how I wish I could just hold you by your neck and punch some sense into you. You're suffering. I know you are. There's no denying that you're suffering. And you still have hopes for tomorrow. You're suffering today. You have lived for the last 25 years and you have suffered every single day of the last 25 years and you're hopeful that tomorrow will be better. Wow. You deserve an award. You're hopeful, aren't you, that your next marriage will work out for you? You're hopeful that the next million will work out for you, right? That will give you the happiness that your last 25 didn't bring you. The next million will make you happy. You're hopeful about that, aren't you? You're hopeful that the next job that you're going to go into, the next promotion you're going to get, is going to make you happy, right? Because the last several didn't do it for you, but the next one will, right? You're hopeful that the next child will make you proud, aren't you? The last two brought you shame, disappointments, but the next child is going to make you happy, right? That's why I say you deserve an award. Because you seem to have an understanding that I don't. That's why I say I feel like holding you by the neck and punching some sense into you. You know, we can laugh about all this, but at the end of the day, your life is ticking away. This is the only thing that's yours. The only thing that's yours is this. Right? So when this is done, you're gone. Agreed? Because this is the only thing that's yours. When this is done, you're gone. Your car's gone. You're not gone, are you? Your house is gone. You're not gone. Your business collapses. You're not gone. But when this is gone, you're gone. Yeah? So this is the only thing that's yours. And you tell me that this is the most precious thing to you. But look at what you're doing. Just look at what you're doing. Spending away the most precious thing you have and the only thing that you actually have and you own to acquire things that you don't actually own. And none of them will stay with you. And besides, none of them will actually bring you any happiness as well. When are you going to understand this? When are you going to understand this and actually do something about it? How many more years do you want to mull over this? Ponder over this? This predicament? How many more years shall we consider? Because while you're considering, this is ticking away. While you're pondering over this, while you're considering this, right, putting it on the balance, what are the positives, what are the negatives? Is Swaminas is saying, is it actually right? But you know, I've got my money, got my family, got all this, that and the other. Your life is ticking away. Your wife today might be someone else's tomorrow. But look at how many years you've put into, how many years you've sacrificed for her. Your husband today might be someone else's tomorrow. Because that was not yours. The only thing is yours is your life. But you're so happily sacrificing your life for your wife. You're happily sacrificing your life for your husband. Something that is yours today but might be someone else's tomorrow. But what about your life? It's the only thing you have. I know none of this is going to change you. Because you are so determined to make this work for you, right? You are so determined to prove me wrong, aren't you? Wow. Hats off to you. 200 against 1. I'm here trying to convince you that all of this is a worthless investment. You were born happy. You're sacrificing 100 years of happiness that you were born with to acquire all of these things, which are merely material possessions and they're not yours at all. It's only yours on a piece of paper. If that piece of paper was burnt in a fire, then it doesn't belong to you at all. You're spending something that has no returns and no refunds. They don't give you your time back in case later on you decide that was a worthless investment. You don't get your time back either. You don't get your health back. Right? You don't get that back. How can you be so audacious? How can you be so bold? Why do you keep thinking that this is going to work out one day? Where's the evidence? What's the proof that you have? The richest people who lived in this world die crying. They weep. They lament. They write in their autobiographies, I wish life were different. I wish there were different circumstances. I wish I had a noble companion in my life. I wish I had a noble friend in my life who would have shown me a different way. People write these things in autobiographies. But maybe those, because it's the last few pages, no one ever gets to read them. I wouldn't have minded if you had no alternative. But you have the Mahasangha. You have enough merits to associate the Mahasangha. I'm here to bring you the Buddha's message. Here's the alternative. What more do you want? Why do you still want to convince me that I'm right, I'm wrong, and you're right? Why are you still trying to convince me of that? Don't you care about yourself? Am I the only one who's supposed to care about you? Am I the only one who's supposed to care about you? Madam? Sir? Am I the only one who's supposed to care about you? What about your part in this? Why do you feel that the next degree is going to bring you happiness? So you've done your bachelor's, do your master's and you'll be happy. Says who? Ask your lecturer, the one who's going to be teaching you your master's, whether he's happy at home. If you fail your exams, he's going to get a pay cut, and so he lives in fear. How can he give you happiness? Name one person that you live with who's actually happy. I mean, you surround yourself with friends and family, right? Name one person who's unconditionally happy. I can give you 500 names. You give me one. At home, I have 500 people I live with. Unconditionally happy. You give me one name. Your husband? If he was unconditionally happy, he wouldn't be your husband today. Your wife? If she were unconditionally happy, she wouldn't be your wife today. She relies on you for her happiness. Meaning, you can only keep her happy while you're still alive. Give her a guarantee. You know, if you love her so much, give her something so that she can be happy when you're gone. What are you going to give her? A child. What are you going to give her? Give her something that she can be happy with when you're gone. Money? Transfer everything that you have into your name to her name and then she's going to be happy? You think so? You really think so? Transfer your business, transfer your car, transfer everything you have. See whether she's going to be happy. So if you really love them, give them something that they can be happy with even when you're not around. Guess what? I can give you something that you can be happy with even when I'm not around. That's because I love you. Your happiness should not depend on me being here. If I'm here giving you something that you can only be happy with when I'm here, I don't really love you. I don't really love you. The Buddha gave us all something so that we could be happy even when the Buddha passed away into Parinibbana. That's why when Venerable Ananda was crying his eyes out on the occasion of the Buddha's passing away, you know what the Buddha said? He summoned Ananda. Said, Ananda, you have been my chief disciple for the last 45 years. But look at you. You're still crying. Is this what I have taught you? This may be not in the books, but here's what I would have said if I were the Buddha. Don't insult me. The tears that roll down your cheeks are an insult to my teachings. I didn't teach you something to be sad, to grieve when I pass away. I gave you something so that your happiness is unshakable. So be heedless. Hasten your practice. And before long, complete your perfections and become an arahant. Those were probably the words the Buddha gave to Venerable Ananda. There were many other Rahatan Muhansas in the area. in the vicinity, none of them were shaken because they had all become sons of the Buddha. They had all inherited the true legacy of the Buddha. Because they had become victors. They had become wealthy. Here's what those Arahatan Mahanses had. Saddha, Sila, Hiri, Ottapa, Panya, Sutta, and Chaga. So I ask you again, am I the only one who must care about you? What about you? You are sitting on a ticking time bomb. You've come into this world with 100-year lease of happiness, and you're expending your happiness to acquire material things, which none of which you can take with you when you go. They won't bring you happiness because they don't inherently have happiness within them. Any happiness you experience is not really happiness, it's merely pleasure. Pleasure is simply relief from vexation, the longing that you wait for it, and the urge that you have that as you wait for it, and the frustration that builds up when you wait for it, and then finally you acquire it, you are relieved from that. That is the pleasure that you experience when you acquire any of these things. So they don't have any happiness to offer you on a plate, but you keep spending many decades of your life trying to acquire those meaningless things. Meaningless not because a car can't get you from A to B. Meaningless because it can't give you happiness. What you exchange for happiness is not happiness. You're fooled. It's a terrible exchange rate. It's the worst there is. You're exchanging happiness for fear, for grief, for sorrow. I'll end on these words, ladies and gentlemen. The Buddha says on one occasion, if there was a modicum of happiness in this world, just a modicum of it, just a tiny fragment of it, as much as a grain of sand, if there was the tiniest bit of happiness anywhere to be found on this earth, Buddhas would not arrive. Buddhas would not walk this earth, if that was so. Ananda, there is not the tiniest fragment, not the tiniest bit, not a modicum of happiness to be found anywhere in this world. And that is why this earth needs Buddhas from time to time to come along and teach human beings that happiness can only be found within. Think about those words. Those are not my words. That's the truth. That's why I gave up. I gave up all these things. Not because I couldn't. Not because I couldn't. I had it all. Not because I couldn't. I just didn't want them anymore. I just want all of you to be happy. You can't buy happiness. You can't buy it from the supermarket. You can't buy happiness by putting a ring on someone else's finger. You can't. I have asked Guru Handru to try and convince you. I've asked him, can you please try and come and convince them, Guru Handru, one of these days? I said, somehow I'm failing, Guru Handru. I don't know what it is I'm doing or I'm not doing, but... So he keeps reminding me, don't keep your expectations. He says, do your part. But don't expect. But I look at you, you know, mothers and fathers of my previous lives. It's hard not to expect, but that is the truth. Ultimately, I mustn't expect. But I keep asking him, can you come along one of these days and try and talk to them so that they can see the light? He said he will. He said he would come one day. But he asked me, are you sure they want to be saved? He said, are you sure they want to be saved, or are they just pretending that they want to be saved? In other words, what he's asking me is, if I teach them the truth, if I convince them that this is the truth, will they be willing to wake up from their dreams? Or have they become too comfortable in their own dreams that they don't want to be woken up? I said, no, Guru Hamdra, it's not like that. They all want to be saved. Maybe I'm just missing the trick. So why don't you come and try it? So he said he would. I convinced him enough to get a date from him. So here's the deal. Before you come on that day, I want you to write off all your property to everyone else. Right? Pay off all your debts. Write off your property, right? Your whoever you want to write it off to. So that you come here as a free man. If you have a daughter who is of age and has to be given away in marriage, arrange the wedding for the next couple of next few days. Right? Give her off. Give her away. Give your son away. Sort out your property, do all that, and make yourself available. So that once he's here and he preaches to you, and if you understand what I'm trying to convince you, if you understand with conviction, then don't delay. Because time is not on your side. The day after Mr. Daniel's ordination, will be the 18th of August. You work out the rest. Okay? I haven't said anything. The day after Mr. Daniel's ordination is the 18th of August, which is a Sunday. You work out the rest. So next week you can come and show me that you have written off your property. Right? In the papers, solicitors must have signed it. Or at least an affidavit. We'll see you then. Okay? I'm doing all I can. I'm giving you everything I've got and then some. I have no more to give. Once I've given you my teacher, that's all I can give you. I just want you to continue doing your merits. Remember, as I said, like right at the beginning, I know it's not your choice. If it were your choice, you would come with me today. It's not your choice. It's your merits and your wisdom. These two things must mature. Mature your merits by doing as many merits as you possibly can. Particularly to support those who want to fulfill the sasana. Because if that is what you want, that is what you must give. It is what I'm doing right now. I want to fulfill the sasana. That's why I'm giving the sasana to you. That's why I'm not here trying to help you, teach you how to make money, because that's what I used to do. I used to go around giving lectures to people as to how they can make money, how they can become successful. I used to read all those books. The Zig Ziglars, you name it, Tony Robbins, and all those people. I've read all those books. how to become successful, how to be productive in your work. I used to go to the gym and I'd have in my ears plugged in all the cassettes, all the tapes, and I used to listen to them. Positive thinking was the blood that ran through my veins. The rich dads and the poor dads, that was my philosophy. That's what I used to talk to people about. I used to give talks like this. But then I realized, that's all this. No, not this. Then I met the Buddha. Once I met the Buddha, I found home. Right, we have an arms round to go on. Because today you're giving the gift of giving, aren't you? And the sun is out. So far, so good. So before God decides that those poor people are not rich enough, let's wrap up for the day and bring today's sermon to a close. So once again, I want you all to rejoice in what you're offering today. Yeah? Today you're not going to offer Swami Nuhasi alms food into his alms bowl, but what you're offering is the opportunity for many people out there who have hardly anything at all. Not in a million years they might be able to come and sit down where you are and listen to a sermon. But we can try and do what we can to bring that day closer to them. Let me leave you with this quote. Actually, I don't think it's a quote, I just made it up. Our purpose in life is to be God's angels. God wishes to do good to his people. Our task is to help people, to bring people closer to God, so that he can help them, show them his love, look after them. Now those might ring one way for those who understand it in biblical terms. In the terms that we describe this, God is essentially their merit power. People have merits that they have acquired throughout samsara. Your task and my task is to take people to their merits or create an environment for them so that their merits will be drawn upon them and those merits will be converted, transformed to real happiness for them. That's why I want you all to be angels. Make sense? Okay. Let's do a merit transfer and bring the sermon to a close. Let us all take a moment then to transfer all the merits that we have acquired today to all those who are deserving of it, particularly reminding ourselves that we have today come along, got together in this premises which have been offered to us out of generosity, so that all those who are interested in attaining the bliss of Nibbana have an environment in which they can practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to Guru Swami Nuhansi as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer merits to those, to our friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes, and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as those who've helped us, supported us, and assisted us in any way, shape, or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these names to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambhudasasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May by the power of these merits they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who passed away in our name, our loved ones, our forefathers, and our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat, and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe. Let us transfer these merits to those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, pandemics, fires, and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends to us, acquaintances to us. They will have helped us, supported us, and assisted us in any way, shape, and form possible and available to them. Out of compassion and an abundance of gratitude towards all of them, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves to be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahat Theranin Mahanse in this life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midatnva, desha ginnen midatnva, moha ginnen midatnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satmayo. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, desha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivansata adeva, nivansata adeva, nivansata adeva.
තුනුරුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුවිත තර වෙත්වා. සාදු, සාදු, සාදු.